Heads up, friends. The unofficial Shopify podcast is made by indie entrepreneurs for indie entrepreneurs and may contain material not suitable for all audiences, like swearing or economics. Listener discretion is advised. This episode is brought to you in part by Growth Collective, the creative first agency specializing in Shopify stores. With rising costs in e-commerce, higher goods prices, increasing shipping rates, and soaring ad expenses, it can be tough to profit. Today, I want you to meet Growth Collective, a creative first agency that has an enviable track record with brands like BombTech Golf, Hush Blankets, CrossNet, Firebelly Tea, and more. By focusing on crafting beautiful ads that resonate with your customer, they not only manage to make advertising profitable for their clients, but actually scale them too. Here's the best part. Growth Collective is extending an exclusive offer to you, our listeners. Get an in-depth audit of your ad account absolutely free. They'll help you uncover new account structures to give you more consistency in your account. And they'll not only study your brand, but your competitors as well, to give you dozens of new creative ideas that'll actually drive your customer acquisition costs down, helping you scale. So if you're feeling stuck with your current team, visit wearegrowth.co and mention unofficial Shopify for unlocking your true store's potential. Today on the Unofficial Shopify podcast, we are talking about a scary pain point that I think every business goes into, and that's cash flow. What are the tricks to managing cash flow without messing it up? Because sometimes you feel like you've got it under control, you know what you're doing, and then things go sideways on you. So what do? I started my first business 2009, my first proper business, and I've got, you know, I took the accounting classes, I read the books, you know, I've been through management school, and yet this is still such a scary, painful thing where I had to screw it up so many times. I had to mess up my cash flow. I had to mess up my taxes. I ended up owing back taxes to the IRS more than once. Also, they're not as scary to deal with as you would think. You know, they want to work things out with you. And so I want to save you from that same pain. And so we've talked in the past about, you know, bookkeeping, accounting, cash flow. I don't think there's ever a bad time to revisit this topic. And so today is the day. We're joined today by guest Matt Putra, who is a fractional CFO with a lot of e-commerce experience. And topics I'm hoping we're going to hit today is managing your cash flow, negotiating with suppliers. Maybe we'll touch on financing. And of course, the man has plenty of business acumen. We'll see what else we can pick his brain on. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
It's so wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.
Establish for us why we should listen to you. Like, what's your experience? How did you get here?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the big ones, right, is I was actually a CFO before I started a fractional CFO business. So what you find these days is as the sort of the industry has grown, you do have people that were, you know, chartered accountants or bookkeepers or controllers, and those people are talented. Do not get me wrong. However, when you're looking at big thorny issues, sometimes you want somebody that was a CFO. I was appointed by a board to be CFO of a corporate group, so it's just a different thing. But I worked for a private equity group. We had, I don't know,
seven, I love PE five, firms.
Yeah, it was super. It was amazing. Best job ever. We managed, it was small, but we managed like $80 million in assets. We did deals with project costs ranging from like $100 to $500 million of project costs. Our investments were 10 to 20% of those projects. And then I'm managing those portfolios and figuring out what was going on in the investees when I'm quite far removed and trying to figure out, is there risk? Is the risk emerging? Can I do anything about it? So had a lot of experience managing big things. And then, of course, managed throughout COVID and a lot of scary changes. And so, you know, during COVID, I had some friends reach out and say, hey, like, I'm struggling. Can you help me with something for my e-commerce business? And I was like, I would love to help. I loved it. And so then I decided to do this more often and then eventually full time. And so now I've probably worked with 40 e-com businesses over the course of the past 4 years. And we get quite good results and pretty consistently.
All right. Given that experience, when a brand reaches out to you, when someone reaches out to you, what's the pain point? What's their concern? There's going to be a thing that triggered why they're like, hey, we got to go talk to, Matt, the fractional CFO.
Mm-hmm. I would say typically it's one of two things. One could be, hey, we're in a jam and we don't know how to get out of it. And that's very common for us. The other is we want to grow really fast and we want to grow really consistently and we don't want to fuck it up. Can you help us? And those two things are why people call. And of course, underlying that is, well, we need help with cash flow. How do we manage our cash flow? How do I know, like, I have this much cash today, but what am I going to need in 9 months from now if I keep growing? Well, we can answer those questions actually, and prepare for whatever the answer is going to be.
One is like planning and preparedness, preemptive. One is, hey, we already messed this up, help.
Yes. And yes. Yeah, basically, yep.
Is there a third one in there?
I mean, we're starting to get interest from venture-backed companies, and they're saying, look, we have a board. It's a lot. Can you help us professionalize? Can you help us do all the reporting? Obviously, board wants to get a return. I want to get a return as a founder. Can you help us figure that out? So we're getting a bit of that now, too.
Let's talk cash flow. Given your experience, and give me the common mistakes. What's the stuff that you see these e-com businesses make over and over with their cash flow?
There's a few. One, poor bookkeeping. So the bookkeeping is done too late, not every month, miscategorized, and people don't look at it. That's one of the biggest ones, because it's like you've all heard the cliche, it's like you're driving blind. So your window is, or you're seeing imagine trying to drive with the lag in your view, like a video game where the things are lagging, you're trying to play, but you can't. Like, it's impossible to fucking play or drive. So we see that time and time again. It's one of the first things we'll fix every single time. We do bookkeeping, but we can also help your bookkeeper fix theirs, whatever. The second one is adding fixed costs too early, too fast. Fixed costs being rent, staff, agencies, so on and so forth. The general rule for e-com business is that a dollar of fixed cost requires $4 to $6 of revenue to cover it. So imagine if you add a $1,000 person a month, which they don't exist unless you're hiring from offshore, you have to bring in an extra $5,000 revenue just to pay for that person, let alone to put money in your own pocket. So we see people adding fixed costs way too fast, way too often. And the next would be inventory. This is a newer one. People are buying too much and they're sitting on SKUs that don't turn. And so they're taking bags of money and they're putting them on a shelf and they're leaving them there when they could be using them for growth or whatever, what have you. So those are the three really big ones.
Okay. And within those, now flipping a little, what are the key factors I should be keeping an eye on? What are the KPIs, the metrics? I don't know. What should I... To be able to do this, I have to first have decent bookkeeping. And decent bookkeeping being within 30 days of a transaction occurring, I have categorized it, meaning we know it's like, this is a business expense and this is what it was. And so we could figure out then based on that, now we have a profit and loss statement that's monthly, a balance sheet that's monthly. So that's like table stakes. So I got to start with that. If I've done that, then what am I looking for within it?
Yeah, and I will add too that 30 days is a good number, but what we want to see is that your books, so let's say January, it's almost the 31st, so your January books are complete by February 15th. If you wait much longer than that, the information is too old and it's hard to make decisions. But anyway, so other than that, so what else can we look at? Big one. We all know Taylor Holiday talks about this too, is contribution margin. So contribution margin being revenue. And you remove every single variable expense. So the materials, inbound shipping, outbound shipping, payment processing, CAC, the spend to acquire a customer, influencer commissions, variable sharing of revenue with whatever influencers, affiliates. Remove all the variable expenses. What should be left over is, for a general e-com business, 20 to 30% of revenue. So that means of $100, after all the variables are taken away, you have $20 or $30 left, which go into either paying you, paying for more inventory, paying for your staff, so on and so forth. And that's a big one.
Number one, we need our books need to be up to date and within 15 days of the close of the month. Then we need we want to make sure we're tracking contribution margin as a KPI. So we know, like, on this order, this is what, this was the real value to us.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, the other thing, you know, and one of the things I didn't say about the three mistakes is that is people are mismanaging the marketing spend. We don't see that as much as we used to. Agencies Good. And clients have professionalized in a way that was not true even 2 years ago. That was the first thing we always fixed, and we made tons of money for people because of it. But people are doing a lot better with that these days. And so that's why it wasn't one of those things. But of course, you want to have your daily, weekly reporting for those things as well. And contribution margin is part of that. So contribution margin. The other thing you want to look at is your CAC payback period. So ideally, it's 3 months or less. If you have a very strong subscription business, it could be 6. Anything beyond that, you better have a very strong balance sheet or venture money or something. But you can make it work.
CAC, customer acquisition cost?
Customer acquisition cost. So if you pay, you know, $100 to acquire a customer, they should be paying that all the way back to you within 3 months. Most businesses, if you're not subscription, should aim to be first purchase profitable, meaning you're paying, let's say you're paying $80 to acquire a customer, and their contribution margin is 80 or 81 or something like that on the first order, ideally, right? The next thing in terms of cash flow you want to look at is your like net or EBITDA or net profit margin. You know, that will fluctuate a lot for a lot of e-commerce businesses, but for an average for a year, under 10% is very hard to manage a business. So your net profit should be over 10%, ideally every month, but at least in any given 3 to 6 month window, it should be 10%. 20%, we would imagine just being more profitable is easier, of course. Because what happens is as you grow, your revenue keeps growing, and you have to keep buying more inventory for that future revenue, but that sucks up all your profit. So if your profit's high enough, you can counterbalance that.
Turns into this like horrible, never-ending cycle.
Well, exactly. And if you're not careful, what then you do is you go and you get Wayflyer or Shopify or Clearco or one of these financing providers, and not only is your profit getting sucked into inventory, it's getting sucked into paying these debts back too. So it gets into this crazy cycle. So net profit, 10 to 20% is ideal. Then inventory turns. This is tough because some people have to order from China, but ideally on your balance sheet, you wouldn't have more than 3 months worth of inventory. Now there's a calculation for this. If someone Googles it, it's called days sales in inventory. You can Google it. Investopedia will have a really easy calculation. Use that. 3 months would be the best case. Anything less than that is, of course, ideal. Way better. If you could have only a month, I mean, unbelievably better. But that's one. Days sales inventory, 90 days or less. And then gross margin. You know, I used to say that you could be pretty happy at 50 to 60% gross margin in e-commerce. I don't think that's the case anymore. If you want to be a happy owner, 70% is probably your target. If you can't find a product to sell for 70, it's going to be a grind. But if you can get velocity, then it can be okay because you can get to your break even quite quickly. But I mean, I would say 60 is like your minimum these days. It used to be 50.
So 60% contribution margin.
I don't know, gross margin. Contribution margin.
Okay.
Yeah, gross margin. So after your product cost, contribution margin, I like to target 20 to 30%. That to me is a scalable contribution margin. If it's less, it can be okay, but you better be well funded. So 20 to 30% is ideal.
And it surely you've got experience, you know, with clients using Shopify. Are there apps or tools that are your go-to that you recommend?
We love Lifetimely over here. We also love Triple Whale. In fact, a lot of our clients, we pay for the base Triple Whale included in our fees for them because you get a level of reporting that's quite nice because you get that daily, weekly, you know, ad spend, revenue, contribution margin. You can load your rent and all the stuff into Triple Whale for them, and it can actually give you like a P&L every day almost. So we love that. You can see how your net profit looks estimated each day. And of course, then those that believe in attribution can turn on that side of things or not. But we at least get something that we can log in every day and check how clients are doing. So we like that. Those are the two big ones I would say. Lifetime Lead, Triple Whale. I don't use any other ones than that.
What about for bookkeeping?
Oh yeah, of course. Sorry. QuickBooks, Xero are the two really big, easy ones. NetSuite, be careful with, but it is a good platform if you have people that can run it. Most businesses I work with don't use anything other than those main three.
You'd mentioned it is one of the mistakes is inventory. Just like inventory is cash sitting on the shelf. What role does inventory management play in this healthy cash flow? How do we manage that?
Oh man, it's huge, right? So there's slow turning SKUs is a big problem, because imagine if you put a bag of money on the shelf, you take it off in 5 days versus you get to take it off in 90. Well, obviously you want to do only the 5 days one. And so I see people fairly consistently, they have like cart builders, or they're looking for AOV bumps, or they're looking for another product they can sell to somebody. And so then they invest in these other products, but they don't turn very quickly, and their customers, for whatever reason, don't buy them at any sort of velocity. And so you have money just sunk into these low turning SKUs, where what I would do is don't have them, and test occasionally, but if it doesn't work, don't continue to have them, and put that money back into more acquisition or what have you. The other thing that I would say is people generally should buy less inventory at a time. This is actually something I'm seeing getting better too, but people tend to, I don't want to sell out, I don't want to sell out, so they buy too much. Well, I think it makes sense to allow yourself to sell out occasionally, not if you're an Amazon seller, but if you're a Shopify seller, it's okay to sell out here and there. I think there's a exclusivity sort of viewpoint customers can have when something looks sold out sometimes. Obviously, counterbalancing with lost sales. But for me, I see much more issue with buying too much inventory in the day-to-day of clients that we have than buying less. So buy less. The other thing you can do is, and we might talk about this when you're ready, is negotiating with your suppliers. That's a big part of inventory management, and we can talk about that when it makes sense.
Friends, are you ready to level up from inventory headaches? While Shopify's tools are great to start, let's talk Finale inventory for the full journey. I got the scoop from Pauline at Finale.
Finale can tell you, you know, with reordering, sales history, sales velocity, what you're running out of, what you need to reorder, what you need to get ahead of. And then we track the digital order to the actual item received at your back door, onto your shelves and into your warehouses, to your sales channel, after it's sold, off the shelf, out of your warehouse, to the customer.
Finale isn't just an inventory management system. It's an advanced IMS that integrates seamlessly with Shopify, handling everything from purchase orders, inbound shipments, transfer orders, to giving you insights on landed costs and COGS.
When you call the team, mention Unofficial 2024, and your listeners can get 20% off their first 3 months with Finale.
Take your e-commerce operations to the next level with Finale Inventory. Start with a free 2-week trial and see the difference it makes. Head over to Finale Inventory and don't forget the code UNOFFICIAL2024 for your special offer. One more cash flow question for you.
Yeah, anything.
The very first Shopify store we built was a bike shop. It was Ambling Cycle, was like the recumbent bike shop in Chicago. And a bike shop, very seasonal business, put it in Chicago. Now it's an extremely seasonal business. Any tips or advice on handling fluctuating cash flow during a seasonal business like peak and off season?
Yeah, so I would imagine bikes in Chicago is very, very seasonal, as in like you're not doing a lot in the winter, right, at all?
Yeah, only it's like, you know, you have the 1% of the best customers who know, like, all right, I'm going to build next season's bike in January. But other than that, you're really not doing much.
I actually worked with a bike store this past year, and it was similar because I'm in Vancouver, Canada, so it gets not as cold, but cold. I would suggest going on pre-order or deposit in the winter. And this is a pretty conservative view of things, which sometimes you should expect from a bean counter like me. But I would suggest if you can do pre-order or deposit, do that rather than holding way too much inventory that doesn't move. Because imagine having stacks of bikes there and your staff need to get paid, but the money's in the stacks of bikes you can't do anything with and they're not going to move for 3 months. So would you rather miss one or two sales or pay the guy that's your key mechanic or whatever. I mean, let one or two sales go and keep the money and make sure your staff are happy and that you have growth capital and that you as an owner are not like, cause what happens when you run out of cash or getting close to that line is you think suboptimally. So it's not just that you're tight and you got to figure out how to pay people, but it's that you then as an owner begin to think more short term. You begin to freak out and you make suboptimal decisions and you don't sleep and there's all these things that happen. And so if you can just lose a few sales by not having the bikes there, can you then think better through the winter? I mean, I think that's worth it in some cases.
I think so. I think that's also an important thing to note is when you're not, you know, when you're not in that abundance period and you suddenly you have that scarcity mindset and mm-hmm. you're worried, you're right. If you're not really interrogating your own thinking, you can make some poor decisions unintentionally mm-hmm. that after the fact are obvious to you, like, oh, that's why I did that. I should.
Yeah. And what we would do for somebody and what we did for this other bike company was obviously we're just forecasting, right? So we're going to look at what do your typical winter sales look like on a good, you know, good case, sort of average and like worst case. And somewhere between those cases is reality. And we're going to look at what if we sell X versus Y versus Z, and then what happens to cash in each of those scenarios. And we're going to kind of pick a lane that optimizes for missing some sales, but not losing too much cash. That's what we would actually do for somebody. And so that's what I would suggest people do is like kind of pick three scenarios of sales. Then you can figure out how much inventory you should have. Then you can figure out how much cash flow you need and then pick a lane and live with it, right? Pick a conservative lane is though what I would say.
Let's talk something a little more fun, negotiating with suppliers. Hold on, I can negotiate with these people?
Absolutely, yes.
Give me the strategy. What do I need to do to effectively negotiate with suppliers?
So the biggest concept here, we call them nibbles. And this is something I learned from a very good friend of mine named Kevin. Nibbles are small requests that are easy for a supplier to say yes to. So if you're in a situation where you order from China and you have to pay like a 50% deposit or a 70% deposit or whatever, what have you, and then you pay the rest before they ship, your first question to them is not, can I not pay zero deposit? It is, can I pay 40% instead of 50? It's very easy for someone to say yes to, especially if you've paid on time for the past 3 months and you're likely to get a yes. That's your first nibble. Now execute that. Pay it on time, do what they say. In 2 or 3 months, go, look, I know that we usually pay the balance on shipping. Can I pay 1 week after shipping while it's still in the water? Great. Pretty easy to say yes to. Cool. Execute that. Do what you said. 2, 3 months. Again, come back. Go, hey, you know what? Can I pay when it lands at the port now? Great. Done. Small nibble. Easy to say yes to. Now, can I pay a 30% deposit? You know, and so what you're doing is you're trying to figure out in a relationship with your supplier, what are these things they will likely say yes to? Ask for little things at a time and then build up the relationship and do what you say you're going to do. We have a client who at this point now has 60-day terms when they need it from someone in Asia. And that supplier is now keeping excess stock for them at no cost, just in case there's spikes and bumps. And the reason why this is happening is this client of ours went over there, has gone over there once a year, every year. They'll do karaoke. They'll get fucking hammered. They'll have fun. They'll do all the stuff. They'll have a relationship. They know their kids' names. And they do what they say they're going to do, and they pay on time. And if they can't pay on time, they send a message weeks in advance saying, look, I got a bit of a jam here. I'm going to pay you in 5 days after I said I would. And so you build the relationship. And you ask for the nibbles, and it's awesome. The other thing you can do is forecast for them, right? But yeah.
So I think the cornerstone here is long-term relationship building. It is
100%.
You're not out the gate with a new supplier being like, all right, we'll pay in 60 days. It's not going to work because they don't know you yet. You don't know each other. You don't have that relationship. And so you're really, by making small, reasonable requests after you've already proven that you will act in good faith, and then you're able to build that relationship over time, that's the magic here, is really is being a good partner.
Absolutely. And And like I said about the forecasting piece, we got the last set of new terms when we started giving them forecasts. So we said, look, the year is going to look like, we think it's going to look like this. We're going to grow by, I mean, in this case, 30% or more. But we gave them, look, this is what we want in units from you. So the materials that we're going to need and the units from you are going to look like this over the next 6 months. And Spotify goes, oh, cool. Well, interesting. Could you do any better? We're like, well, actually, if we paid a little bit late, I can put that 30 days of money back into growth and sell this much. And Spotify goes, oh, interesting. Okay, well, that makes sense for me too. And so then it is all about relationship, communication, transparency, and visiting them in person is a superpower that we've sort of lost, especially with younger folks. I mean, I think you said you're 40, but I'm 38. And so meeting people in person is still something that's really, really powerful.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. The people you've hung out with in person, they're more real, right? Like there's a stronger impression and feeling in your mind about those folks. I cherish a lot of the time I've spent in person with people. Mm-hmm. Within e-commerce, within this space, nothing against the people I hang out with on Zoom or via text, there's a bonus emotional connection factor that happens. Absolutely. When you hang out face to face. Within negotiating, I love the advice. Is there anything else in there? Any other tips or techniques?
Yeah, if your business is a bit more mature, there are some financial tools you can use. So if you're an e-com brand and you have a supplier in Asia, e-com brand goes to their bank and they say, bank, I want what's called a letter of credit. What that means is the bank goes to the supplier in Asia and says, look, if e-com brand doesn't pay, we'll cover it. And so then the supplier has comfort that they can send their stuff across the ocean. And if e-com brand goes bankrupt, for some reason, the bank's going to pay. So they're fine. It's called a letter of credit. The next thing you can do sometimes is pay a bond. And again, you have to be a bit more financially healthy, but you as e-com brand send your supplier 50K and they just keep that 50K always as a guarantee of future payment. And I've seen that work quite well for someone in the UK with a Chinese supplier. They had like a 50K bond and they had 30-day terms with their Chinese supplier. So they'd send stuff across the water, no problem. But it's, again, trust, right? What can you do to increase the trust? And like I said, there are some financial tools to do that. Letters of credit, bonds. Sometimes brokers can be really good because a broker will have relationships and they will sort of cultivate relationships on your behalf. I think that could be hard to find. But there are brokers that I know that have done really good work on that, especially if it's a bigger broker. Actually, I have two clients that have brokers that are really, really effective. One in India, one in Cambodia. And they've been awesome.
We've heard on the show before that brokers could really be quite beneficial, especially when you're new to it. And finding a supplier can be intimidating or fraught with peril potentially if you haven't done it before.
100%. Yeah, but this is where I wouldn't know how to look and find for a good broker. I know that I've worked with two or three right now. But there's a guy in India that we worked with, and we've got into a factory that we would never get into this factory normally. But this relationship with this broker, and he believes in where we're going, and he got us into the factory. So they can be really fantastic. Yeah.
So maybe this is a silly fear, but if I'm negotiating with my supplier and we're looking at cost savings here, is there any fear that like suddenly the quality on what they produce will go down?
I mean, yeah. So you mentioned cost savings. So, and I didn't actually say that, but you should obviously always be looking at cost engineering your stuff down a little bit. But you need to find that inflection point where the quality stays where your customers want it and your costs can be moved around a little bit. You have to be very clear with your supplier that, look, and again, I'm not a purchasing expert necessarily, but you want to be clear that you need your quality to be such and such. And you want to have sort of quality hurdles typically. So, defect rates and certain types of materials and all that. If you just willy-nilly push too hard and say, cut the cost by 10%, I don't give a fuck what you have to do. Well, yeah, what do you think is going to happen, right? Someone's going to cut corners somewhere. But I think, again, if you have the relationship and you're clear about what you really want, which is, I want good product in the hands of customers who are going to come back and buy from me again, and I want quality, And I also want to see what I can do about cost savings. Then I think your supplier will be okay. Sometimes you need to look for an alternate supplier if they won't play ball. And we have someone in that process too, but that's really hard as well. Can be yeah. very hard.
So we've got, well, all right. So once we've got our cash flow sorted out, we have a good grip on that. And you know, we've secured our supplier and we're building that relationship. There's still pretty big cash outlays I have to make to get the product. And then the product is on my shelf as an asset, but it's still, my cash is tied up in it. And then I sell it and hope, and I get the cash back, but not all at once, right? Unless I'm doing B2B, I'm getting it a little bit at a time. And yeah, potentially I'm in a seasonal business too, so there's slow periods. It becomes, you know, at some point it almost becomes a necessity that I take on debt, that I have financing. And so that could be scary. Talk me through financing strategy, your financing strategy.
Okay, so let me give you the ideal. And most people won't do the ideal, and so I won't spend a ton of time on it. The ideal is that you look at your average inventory throughout the course of the year, and what you'll find is there's a floor value to what you're going to carry. We'll call that your working capital base. That floor value you should finance with a term loan of like 5 years, so SBA, or if you can get it from a bank. Now, most people won't do that because personal guarantees are required, but that's literally the ideal. Why? Because you're going to get a 5-year term loan, and it's going to cover your absolute minimum amount of inventory you need to have, and it's going to cost you not that much. Right now, it would be 8 to 10%. The payments will be like, I don't know, quite low, and so that's a great first step. The second step, you're going to get a line of credit, and that will help you finance those peaks and valleys in your purchasing patterns. And then obviously, you always have Shopify and Clearco for big, big spikes and big peaks. In absence of the term loan, which most people don't want, I would suggest Sellers Fi is a good company. They have 15-month term loans. And Kickfurther also has stuff where you get capital from them and you can start your payback in 6 months and pay down over like 10 months or whatever. So that's helpful. And the principle throughout what I'm saying is more important. And that is that when you take financing, match it the length of payback on the financing with the length of return of the purpose. Meaning, if you're going to go get money for inventory, don't go get Clearco because you pay that back in 4 months and you can't sell through all the inventory in 4 months. So it doesn't make sense. Go get a loan from Sellers Fi because you can pay the Sellers Fi back over 15 months and you sell all your inventory in 15 months and it gives you a chance to get out of the cycle. You can use Clearco, or you should use Clearco in some cases, to scale effective ad spend. Why? Well, if you acquire a customer today, they're typically going to come back, and or let's say you have a dollar you spend today on ads will come back in 30 approximately. Or if you know your CAC payback is 3 months, Clearco is 3 to 4 months. So it makes sense to get Clearco to buy more customers. You see how I'm matching how fast I have to pay back the capital with how fast I'm going to get a return from the activities for which I'm using it for. That is the principle. So in as much as possible, follow that principle and you will be relatively happy as an owner. But if don't follow the principle and you're fucked, because what I've seen before is I've seen people get Clearco and they're paying Clearco in 4 months and the inventory's not even arrived yet. And so they're taking another Clearco to pay for the first Clearco. And it's a nightmare, right? But that's because the payback timeline of the financing didn't match the return of the activity they're using it for.
Okay. So when you phrase it like that, it's like, all right, the type of loan, the terms of the loan, whether or not you take the loan, really need to be based on what I'm using it for. So in this case, it's like our debt dollars, that every one of those dollars has a job. What is that doing? You know, and how are we going to turn that into an ROI to pay it back?
I like the way you said that. Yes.
As we ring in the new year, did you know that over 90% of Shopify merchants won't hit their maximum revenue in 2024? Ugh! That's because they're killing their conversion rates by using outdated landing page designs and default templates. You work hard all year, and you deserve to realize your dream of owning a successful store. But without the right tools, it's like running a marathon with lead weights tied to your feet. That's where Zipify Pages comes in. Zipify Pages is the game-changing landing page builder created by the founder of a $180 million Shopify store. It has everything you need to transform your store into a high-converting, sales-generating machine. Zipify Pages' intuitive builder, mobile-optimized templates, and AI-powered features are helping thousands of Shopify stores boost their conversion rates and run more profitable marketing campaigns. Zipify Pages improves every page on your Shopify store. Just select a template from their template library and then quickly customize it to match your brand. You can easily create better product pages, landing pages, category pages, even home pages. And because every Zipify template is tested on their $180 million Shopify store, you know they actually work. So don't let 2024 drift by with unmet revenue goals. Upgrade your store today with Zipify Pages and make this your best new year yet. Go to zipify.com/Kurt to start a free 14-day trial. That's zipify.com/KURT to try Zipify Pages for free. Well, have you ever played with the Shopify has financial services like Shopify Capital, Shopify Lending now?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, we analyze that all the time because, I mean, to be frank, I mean, it's been a tough couple of years. And so most people I know have used Shopify Capital at least a few times in the last few years. And typically the payback is 4 months and the typical actual interest rate is like 30%. And it's just, they may tell you that you're going to get 200 grand with an 8% interest charge. But when you look at how interest works, it's actually 30% interest.
So you really got to double check, like, okay, these are the terms, and then let's sit and calculate what my APR is.
Exactly. Yes, APR.
30%?
That's like the minimum I've seen from Shopify. I've seen 40, 50.
My credit card is less than that.
Well, this is the crazy thing. I looked at a loan from, who was it? I forget the name, but Kickfurther can be 50% APR. But the payment terms are so good that sometimes it's worth it, right? Because what you want, I mean, again, you're matching the payback timeline. The debt is doing its job in the timeline it's supposed to. So sometimes you eat a very high interest rate so that you have payback terms that help you. So with Kickfurther, I've seen 50% before, but they got 6 months of zero payments, meaning that they sold their inventory and the gross margin was paying the loan, which means they can actually get out of the cycle. But if you're taking a loan to pay back another loan, you're stuck in a cycle. So 50% does make sense sometimes.
Okay. So I like the approach here. I like the mindset and the thinking about it. Anything, but like inherently taking on debt is risky. Is there anything else we could do to manage that risk?
Yes. So there's a guy named Rob Fraser who owns Endure Apparel and the socks guy, the custom socks. He grew his business was bootstrapped until it wasn't, but he grew from like 0 to 10 million without outside capital by just selling stuff that he could afford to buy. And then when he sold it, buying more shit that he could afford to buy. And so he grew slower, but he's doing awesome. Like, I think he would do it the exact same way again. And he talks about this on his LinkedIn and stuff, and he's probably been on some podcasts. So Google that story, because he literally started, I could afford 100 socks with my savings, buy 100 socks, sell the 100 socks, buy what you have in your savings and buy what you can afford to buy. So growing slow
Outweigh
is
socks.
Sometimes.
Outweigh socks. I'm wearing Outweigh socks right now.
Sorry. And Rob, if you hear this, I'm very sorry. It was Endure. Now it's Outweigh. My bad.
I was like, Rob Fraser socks. I'm like, that's really familiar. And I Googled it. It's Outweigh socks.
You might need to edit that. But anyway, it's fine. But yeah, no, Outweigh. So follow him. Listen to that story. I'm sure he's told it a handful of times on podcasts and whatnot. But, you know, that's one of the only examples. Well, actually, no. Yeah. And someone else did that too in the UK. Someone I worked with. And they just they bought what they could afford to buy and then rolled that into new stuff. And they were very, very conservative. So this is the thing. You can do it that way, but you have to be conservative with fixed costs, conservative with inventory buys, conservative with forecasting, conservative with agencies, conservative with live on a shoestring until you can afford the bigger rent for your bigger apartment. Like, be very, very, very careful. But if you do that, you can do it this way. And and these people are happy because they don't have the same stress that others do. And to be frank, that's not the way I run my business. I run it faster than I should, but I use some debt too. But that's because I like the growth and it's fun. And my wife and I can handle the stress. So
yeah, part of it's just like, what are you personally
100%?
What's your personal risk tolerance?
100%. And my wife and I are prepared to move to Colombia or Bali or somewhere if we need a year that we don't have enough money to, you know, live in Canada. We'll move somewhere else for a year to keep reinvesting. To Medellin. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, I know a guy there right now. But if that's your risk tolerance, then fucking go for it. But just be aware that you're playing a game, and it's, you know, there's some winners and some losers.
Yeah, that risk is always there, no matter what. Even if you're bootstrapped, the risk is still there.
True. That's true. Yes.
So, okay, let's zoom out here. Based on your experience, what are some commonalities, some traits of the financially sound and successful e-com businesses?
The big one that I've seen and I've never changed is they're lean as long as they can be lean. So they keep costs down. They're just careful as long as they can be. And those people, by and large, have been the least stressed, having the most money owners. And there are outliers. And I know a guy that went really hard and then it all worked out. He sold his business. But from what I can tell today, just be cautious, be conservative. And those people are the least stressed people I work with. It does work out the other way, though, too. But
yeah, the more aggressive you get, often it'd be the more debt you have to take on, the more chances you have to take. And every one of those things is you are adding additional risk exposure to your life and business.
But, you know, but I work with someone today.
But that's a big bet, too. High risk, high reward.
This is the thing. So you make a good point. So I'll say that I work with someone. Oh, you know what the other one is? A great product. Sorry, I shouldn't forget to mention that.
Oh, yeah. That's where like, well, that's just obvious.
Yeah, well, I guess so. But a really fantastic product, right? So I know a guy who lost high six figures 2 years in a row. Ugh. Now is making high six figures because their product just resonated with their customers. Their customers love it. And they could sell on pre-order for six fucking months and their people would just keep buying it at a ROAS of 4 or 5, right? So if you have a good product, sometimes you can afford to be nuts with how you run the business.
I like that advice. We talked successful traits. Give me the single most challenging thing about, you know, being financially literate with your e-com business.
It's the amount of information you need to be able to digest regularly and make decisions. That's the hardest thing about it. And that's why people have fractional CFOs, and there's fractional CFOs that have courses like Jason Andrew from SBO Financial made a course for emerging e-com owners to help understand. And I think it literally is just the amount of shit you have to manage, like staff and not just financially, you have to do all the operations too. So to me, I think it's, if you have an MBA, so you're probably set up in some ways more than others, right? But there's just so much information, and how do you know what are the right things to focus on? Even that's a big one. There's so much data these days. What's the right number for you to look at? So I think that's the toughest. There's a lot to know.
Yeah, you could very easily just be drinking from the fire hose, get overwhelmed, and like absolutely have the right info in front of you and totally miss it.
100%. Yeah.
What's the one piece of financial advice you want people to walk away from this episode with?
Stay lean, be conservative. By and large, there's more people that do that and are less stressed than the other way around.
Avoid shiny toy syndrome and getting in over your head as a result.
Yeah. When you find a leverage point, leverage it. But until you find it, don't just fuck around and spend money. Like, you know.
I like the advice. And you made this like practical and accessible and not jargon filled. This was a good episode. I appreciate it. Where can we learn more about you?
Sure. Yeah. So LinkedIn, you could look me up, Matt Poutra. My website is 8x.co, EIGHTX.co. Either of those places, come join me. Find me on LinkedIn. Let's chat.
Beautiful. Matt, thank you so much. This has been, well, informative and fun. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Kurt. I really appreciate it.
Crowdfunding campaigns are great. You can add social proof and urgency to your product pre-orders while reducing risk of failure. But with traditional crowdfunding platforms, you're paying high fees and giving away control, all while your campaign is lost in a sea of similar offers. It can be frustrating. That's why we built Crowdfunder, the Shopify app that turns your Shopify product pages into your own independent crowdfunding campaigns. We originally created Crowdfunder for our private clients, and it was so successful, we turned it into an app that anyone can use. Today, merchants using Crowdfunder have raised millions collectively. With Crowdfunder, you'll enjoy real-time tracking, full campaign control, and direct customer engagement. And it's part of the Built for Shopify program, so you know it's easy to use. So say goodbye to high fees and hello to successful store-based crowdfunding. Start your free trial and transform your Shopify store into a pre-order powerhouse today. Search Crowdfunder in the Shopify App Store to get started.